Hello and welcome to the Mother Earth News Online Homesteading Summit. This is Marjorie Wildcraft. I'm your host for the summit. And I am so excited about this next presentation. It's going to be all about other varieties of corn to grow other than sweet corn, and it's being presented by Hank Will himself. I'm going to tell you a little bit about Hank for just a second, but I'm so excited. I go to a lot of Mother Earth news fairs, and I'm often a presenter there, and I just don't often get to see the other presenters because I'm talking to people, and I'm presenting, and I'm having fun, and I'm getting totally distracted, and I'm shopping, and really, these events are so much fun that I often don't get to see what everybody else is talking about, and I kept seeing Hank's thing on the schedule and going, I really want to see that. Well, we finally got Hank to sit down and record this video for us so that we could show it to you, and I'm so excited. So Hank is the managing director, the editor-in-chief for Ogden Publications. I mean, really, he's in charge of, you know, Mother Earth News and Grit and all those wonderful magazines. He has a small-scale, high-cash-flow farming experience that spans more than four decades, with projects as varied as native perennial plants and heirloom-laying chickens. He just does so many things. He's co-authored seven books and hundreds of articles, and he, of course, maintains a lot of open pollinated corn varieties, which you're going to see. And I love how he ties in how this has been handed down from his father and his grandfather and his great-grandfather throughout the decades. And they have even gotten some of this original corn seed from the Native Americans, from the Mandan Indians. I think you're going to really enjoy this presentation.
Hi, this is Hank Will, editorial director for Ogden Publications. I'm also the editor-in-chief at Heirloom Gardener and Mother Earth News magazines. We also publish Grit, Mother Earth Living, and several other titles here in Topeka, Kansas. It's the first time for me doing a voiceover, a PowerPoint, so please bear with me. I don't have my visual cues from my audience, and I also don't have the ability to pace around the room and wave my hands, which is what I would normally do. So the title of my talk today is Can the Sweet Corn? A Case for the Backyard Grower. Before I even proceed, I want to give a shout out to several people who have inspired me along the way with corn, not to mention some of my ancestors, which I'll talk about too. Dave Christensen's been working on a land race variety of corn that will perform in really short season areas up in the north, as well as longer season areas. He calls it Painted Mountain, and it's fairly available. It's very beautiful. It's a very lovely flower corn, mostly flower corn, although it's got genetics from all kinds of different native corns worked into it. He's been working on that for about 40 years. John Austin is an avid heirloom gardener, small-scale farmer in Montana that has collected and archived over the years many, many of the varieties that my ancestors released to commerce. Particularly grateful to Roberta Rossini and Emmanuel Mangiani from Italy. They're working on a similar project to David Christensen, trying to put together a highly adaptable land race variety of corn in Italy. And of course, Larry Stevens is my farmer friend from Kentucky. He is just a great guy and has grown out many of the varieties that I've developed over the years. So what I want to talk today about is I want to make the case for growing some corns other than sweet corn. When people think about corn in the garden, they think about sweet corn. And frankly, I think sweet corn is a little bit overrated. I think, you know, we all eat way too much sweet stuff as it is, and the last thing we need is vegetables that are producing such high quantities of sugar that they have a glycemic index that's actually measurable. So let's talk about growing what I would consider to be more grain varieties or specialty varieties of corn. That's really what I want to talk to you about today. So I come into this relatively honestly, well, totally honestly, I guess, but it makes sense. It's kind of in my genes. I always said that it was in my genes. I was born into a a seed company and nursery family that settled at one point in Bismarck, Dakota Territory back in the late 1800s, and by my grandfather, Oscar Henry Will, and I'm actually Oscar Henry Will III. He set up a company called Oscar H. Will & Company, and you know, one of the things that he recognized was that if he was going to grow or produce agricultural seed for that particular part of the country, that he better make friends with those folks who actually had been doing it for years. And so one really wonderful consequence of that knowledge was that Oscar developed a lifelong, very close friendship with the native farmers in the region, mainly Mandan, Hidatsa, and Arikara people who farmed the Missouri River bottoms around Bismarck and points north or upriver. And then my grandfather, George Francis Will, kind of picked up where Oscar left off, and he actually had a degree in archaeology from Harvard and studied the historical and prehistorical aspects to those same farmers along the upper Missouri, and he was adopted into a number of native families. And both of these men were also gifted with lots of different varieties of seed, which they grew out, which they made crosses with, which they also just made selections from to release to the public a number of different varieties. So this particular slide shows a 1919 catalog. The company would have been under my grandfather's guidance. At this point, my great-grandfather would have passed away. And these particular, you can see that corn was a very important piece to the puzzle for them back then. Lots of different colors available back then, too, and different types of corn, both Flint's, Dent's, and some flour corns for sure. They also had popcorns in their offerings, and they did ultimately have sweet corn in their offerings, too, of course. And then they also pay respect to the native folks that produced the, or that helped them learn how to adapt agriculture to that region. And my grandfather, George, carried that sort of theme throughout many, many years of the catalog, where he actually had authentic ceremonial paintings done of Mandan ceremonies, especially corn ceremonies, that they put on the cover of the catalog that archaeologists and anthropologists today actually cite as, you know, evidence for how things might have been done back in the day. So anyway, I have corn in my blood. I can't sometimes shake it. I currently grow out maybe about 27 different varieties of corn. I try to keep them all pure by hand pollinating, isolation, and all that kind of stuff. Every one of them has some purpose. I mean, you can feed them to your chickens, you can eat them in a number of different ways, and I'll try to remember to highlight some of those as we go along. So why corns other than sweet corns? From my standpoint, it's because it's a beautifully macro fruiting grass. It's highly water use efficient. You know, some places where corn grows, you wouldn't imagine that you could grow any crop because it's so dry. It's also incredibly diverse in terms of the plant, the ear shape and size, incredible color diversity. It's actually nutritious, contrary to what, you know, everybody is led to believe. What we call field corn is not a complete food when it comes to the amino acids that it contains. You know, we all kind of know that you can't make a physiological living eating corn, but corn has a lot of protein and a lot of carbohydrate in it, and it has its place, I believe. It's also easy to grow. It's highly adaptable. I mean, there's corn that grows at 10,000 feet. There's corn that grows, you know, up into Canada, well into Canada, and, you know, in the tropics as well. And for me, if I'm going to, you know, play around with virtually any plant, Needs to be versatile, have lots of different uses, and it's got to be gorgeous. So what you're looking at here is a slide just from one of my patches, my corn patches, where I basically took a bunch of extra seed and just planted a completely mixed field in rows and let the pollination happen the way the pollination will happen, and basically kind of take the ears, take a look at the ears, which ears have characteristics that I might want to select out, and then try to line breed forward to develop a new variety, if you will, or the new color or what have you. And this is some of the results of that. You can see there's purple dents and white dents, and there's flints, and there's oranges, and there's browns, and there's yellows, and there's reds and purples, and that's just some of the colors that you can actually get. I'm going to focus a lot on color just because I think color is gorgeous, but we'll talk about different types of corn as well. To understand a little bit more about color as well as kernel characteristics, it requires the use of some terms. Pericarp, aleurone layer, and endosperm. Those are the three that I would focus on in this particular talk. You don't need to have a corn anatomy lesson or a corn kernel anatomy lesson, but basically the color, the visual aspects to the kernels are principally the result of these three layers. The pericarp can either be clear or kind of a translucent material, which will give you a dull color. It can actually also be colored. The aleurone layer can be colored, and the endosperm can typically be shades of yellow to orange or white. In some rare cases, you can get a little more color in the aleurone layer. In the endosperm layer as well. So when we're looking at a green kernel, yes, there are green kernels. In some cases, it's the result of blue and yellow layers on the outside, or a blue combination on the outside, layered over a yellow endosperm or what have you. The endosperm is the starchy area. The aleurone layer is pretty high protein, and the pericarp is really just the coating, the protective coating over the works. The other side of the kernel here is that stuff which is related to the embryo and the plant growth itself. That can have pigments other than carotenoid pigments and chlorophyll. And in some cases, they can be really deeply, darkly red or purple because there's so much anthocyanin in them. So that's just sort of to give you an idea of where color comes from. And we need to think about endosperm a little bit because we need to think about the different varieties of corn. All right, so one of the hardest types of corn, and actually one of the longer storing types of corn, is popcorn. Popcorn has a very special kind of endosperm that is very dense, very, very tightly packed, and it forms a seal, kind of a really hard, flinty, if you will, carbohydrate starchy seal around the more fluffy starch on the inside. And the reason why it pops is because that starch, that outer starch, that sort of flinty layer, really seals up the more fluffy starch on the inside, and the more fluffy starch on the inside contains or has water associated with it, moisture. And so what happens when you heat it is that the water is volatilized and becomes steam, high-pressure steam, which then blows the kernel apart and puffs the starch out in a tasty snack that we all know about. This particular popcorn is a really awesome variety known as Glass Gem. Just Google Glass Gem to find some beautiful, beautiful native history on this gorgeous corn. It's mostly grown as an ornamental, but you can certainly grind it and make a meal. You can make a meal out of it, but I mean you can make a cornmeal, if you will, out of it. You can also pop it. It's not the best popping corn out there because it wasn't developed for the best, largest, puffiest kernels. But you can see here, you've got true oranges, you've got true lavenders, you've got true pinks, you've got a couple of different shades of green, as well as blues, yellows, you name it. The color variation in corn kernels is pretty much the sky the limit. This particular popcorn has a really beautiful glassy-like pericarp, which gives it a kind of a beautiful, shiny, gem-like looking characteristic. Okay, you can also grow flint corns. Flint corns and popcorns are closely related to one another. The flint corns have a little bit more of the fluffy starch in them, but it is still encapsulated in the really hard, dense material. Flint corns can sometimes pop. They don't pop very well. I wouldn't recommend necessarily trying to use them or grow those popcorns, but they grind great. You can roast the ears when they're in the early milk stage. Basically leave them in the husk and put them on the grill, and they'll just be delicious. You won't have as much color in the kernels at that point, but that's fine. This particular variety is one called Burley County Flint, which my great-grandfather developed. It was actually developed by a local farmer, and he took and improved on it and released it to commerce. It comes in all kinds of colors. As you can see here, we have greens. You know, it's very similar, at least in the color variation, although you see some browns here as well. Lots of beauty. The kernels on the left, the leftmost ear, you'll see some sort of a starburst characteristic in that. That's fairly typical of Burley County Flint to have some of that in there, and there are some corns that are almost exclusively that, such as Mandan Society corn. That particular pattern is caused by genes that move around by natural means called transposable elements in the corn, and they cause the patches, the developmental sort of characteristics, shapes or patterns, if you will, of a swirl of color on a different colored background. Interestingly enough, the discovery and the description of what was going on here resulted in a awesome woman, Barbara McClintock, female scientist, who was, you know, certainly a pioneer in terms of science for a woman, when it was, well, even more dominated by men than it is today. But she actually was awarded the Nobel Prize because she worked out how those movable genes work without using any molecular techniques. I mean, we didn't have them back then. She just worked it out, making crosses and building a logical explanation for what was happening, and actually mapping the locations of them on their chromosomes. Anyway, just an interesting little sideline. Also have flower corns. Flower corns have a much softer starch pack. They don't store as well. Much more susceptible to weevils because they don't have kind of a hard starch coating over their fluffy kind of interior. They're really good for grinding, making tortillas or whatever else, and making even cornmeal. But if you want to make finer things, flour corns are pretty good for that. Also awesome to roast, and you can also parch them. They parch up nicely, so you basically pluck out the kernels when they still have some moisture in them, maybe about 18 to 20% moisture. Throw them on a cast iron skillet, and they'll kind of puff, kind of like puffed wheat or puffed rice, if you're familiar with those cereals from the olden days. This particular variety is called Navajo Sacred, and you can see that it's a white flower corn with a fairly spherical looking kernel, and the point at which the silk attaches to the ovary, essentially here, the kernel, develops a purple, in this case a purple pigment, and the pattern of that pigment in many cases takes on this sort of bird silhouette. In some like the Pawnee culture, for example, this corn is called eagle corn. Others call it sacred corn. This particular line of corn I have actually been selecting on for a number of years to select for more of the eagle-shaped figure, which is not what the Native Americans would have done. The corn as they developed it had some of those kernels in it and some of them with more of a amorphous purple blotch on them. Really cool corn to grow. It's gorgeous. It's been hailed on. I've had it where it was knocked completely down in a thunderstorm and it picked itself back up, literally. It's been hailed on and mildly shredded in it, and it grew back. So pretty amazing plant. And I'm pretty low on seeds, so I don't really have any to share at the moment, but I think I've got enough seed out to a number of folks that this thing at least won't get lost. This particular variety was, or strain, was a gift to my grandfather from one of his friends on the Navajo Reservation in, I guess, what's now Arizona, back in 1917, which we've been working hard to keep alive. Then we come to the dent corns. The dent corns are probably the most prevalently grown corns, certainly in the Corn Belt of the U.S. The dent corns are dented because they have a little bit of simple starch, a fairly simple starch that when it dries down, it shrinks sufficiently to cause a dent in the end of the kernel. And if you've ever seen a sweet corn kernel, it looks a little bit like a raisin. It's all shriveled up, and that's because it has relatively little starch or relatively simple starches compared to some of the harder field corns that we've been talking about. This particular corn, shows Oaxacan green dent corn originating down in Mexico. It's a yellow endosperm type corn, type dent corn. It has typically a red cob, and it's green because of the blue in its outer two layers. The cob on the top is a red variant that you'll sometimes find in that particular, you know, in mixtures or in when you buy Oaxacan green. And I could explain the genetics to that to you, but I won't right now because it's really not what this is about. But I have been developing a line of those, or of the red version, for a number of years. It still doesn't breed quite true, but I think I'll get there in another couple of seasons. This corn is a great roasting, grinding soup corn. It's also good for parching. And all these corns have different flavor profiles, and they also have different nutrient profiles as well. So how do you grow these corns? Well, a lot of different ways that you can grow corn. Most folks have seen corn grown in drills or rows. That's kind of how we figured out to make it easy and efficient to grow corn using mechanized tools. Many traditional corns are what are known as social corns, and they actually perform better in a hill. A lot of the Mandan corns are that way. The Navajo sacred corn is that way. So for growing corn in hills, basically what's important is that the corns themselves, the plants themselves, have other plants upon which they can lean. And I think that's part of what makes them social. These corns standing in rows or standing by themselves tend to get knocked over or lodged pretty easily. But when they're grown in a hill, they withstand, you know, they support one another quite literally, physically. So here is one of my smaller corn patches where I grow some of my more rare stuff just outside the sheep yard or one of the sheep pens. And basically what I do is I hoe up, you know, I cultivate the land using a wheel hoe, but loosen it up and then hoe up hills that are about 18 inches in diameter and maybe 4 or 5 inches above the surrounding soil. I flatten the tops, and then I made myself a round-shaped five or six pin dibble or dibber. Basically, you can just sort of press it into the top of the hill, and it drills 5 to 7 holes. I drop a seed into each hole, and then once, you know, pack it, then pat it with my hand, and then once the plants sprout, I'll usually thin to the most robust five looking plants. Gives some for the crows, it gives some for mutation and whatnot. A little bit labor intensive, sure, and I will sometimes grow corn in the same place several years or a couple years in a row if we don't have any cutworm problems or other parasite problems. But I do enhance the fertility every year. In general, I don't grow corn in the same place more than 3 years in a row, and I try not to do it more than 2 years in a row. But Macon Hills is labor intensive, and I like to minimize the labor if I can. You know, one of the things that the people always ask us at the magazine is, well, gosh, I don't have any room. Can I grow corn in a container? Or I only have room on the back porch for a container garden. And so I decided to do an experiment 1 year and say, okay, I wonder if I can produce any corn in large containers. These are the, whatever they are, 100-pound lick tubs, or probably even heavier than that. I estimate them to be about 30, 35-gallon plastic buckets. I drilled holes in the bottom so that they would drain. And these really, if you think about it, emulate hills, right? They're isolated hills. They're not connected to the soil directly, but they're much like hills, and I planted them much like hills. The soil in here is pretty much 100% composted sheep manure with hay, that whole mixture composted. And boy, the corn does seem to love it. Another way that I grow corn is in sort of unconventional places. Corn loves nitrogen. If it's got plenty of water, it'll utilize the nitrogen to the best of its ability. And so in my corral spaces or other spaces where animals are concentrated periodically, the nutrients tend to build up, and I will occasionally then till those and then plant a corn that's very leafy, that can pull or utilize as much of that nitrogen as possible. And then I'll turn around and then feed that back to weaned sheep or what have you. And then I'll, you know, go about selecting corns to plant. Sometimes I'll select by kernel if I'm looking to produce a new blue line, or sometimes I will just randomly mix, or if it's a corn like Burley County Mixed Flint or Dakota Mixed Flint, you know, you want to be sure you just take a grab bag of kernels so that you kind of keep the genetic integrity of the genetic diversity of that particular type of corn or variety of corn intact. Take a handful of seed, plop it in my favorite cedar. I have a number of walk-behind cedars. I think the most versatile one, the most versatile for the smaller patches that I plant is the Haas Tools. is the Haas Tools planter. And this is a planter attachment actually for the wheel hoe. You have a number of different discs that have holes of various sizes for different size seed, but there are a couple in there that work pretty well for corn. This particular corn here is, I think, Reed's Flint, and it's actually got a combination of red and yellow kernels in it. Some people try to select them apart, but I don't see any reason to. Reed's is fairly famous, and it's been made famous in a book also, I think, that was published several years ago. I can't remember the author, so really good information, eh? Yeah, that's what you can expect from me. Publishers was New Society Press, though, a couple of years ago. Well, probably 5 years ago now. So you've got your tilled ground. If you're going to use a planter, you need fairly mellow ground in order to get that to work. Go ahead and plant the corn, whether you're planting in hills or in rows, no matter how you do it. And within, depending on the temperature, a week to 2 weeks, the seedling will emerge. In this particular case, I planted April 1st in Kansas, and we had, you know, the soil was pretty wet, and it was cold still, and we had some cold rains, and so it's looking a little peaked, but it's still come on. That's the cool thing about some of these old variety corns, is that they don't necessarily rot in place. A lot of them are able to germinate when the soil is still well below 65 degrees. give yourself a couple more weeks, and you can see they love that compost kind of soil. I amend all my corn plots with that stuff, whether I'm planting in rows or not. Go a few weeks more, and you can see here that there's a little trench kind of cultivated between the rows. That's a process called hilling, really for my last cultivating, and I cultivate with a wheel hoe typically, or I pull up soil around the hills with a regular hoe. But in this particular case, I've just gone through with the hilling attachment on my wheel hoe, which cultivates, but it also pushes soil up against the stalks. And you can see some weeds laying there. But this is about, let's see, I planted April 1st, so this is around mid-May, and mid-May in Kansas. You know, we still haven't gotten to our last frost date. Actually, some of these plants were frosted, but they came back. Here's the hilling attachment. It's really two moldboard plows facing backwards. We're looking at the implement upside down here, and then one cultivator tying between them. At any rate, you get all that ready to go, and then the thunderstorm whips through with the hail, and you're left with what looks like a pretty shredded mess. I thought that this would be a loss, a total loss, and I was pleasantly surprised. The neighbor's conventional corn was already sprouted up the road, and he lost, you know, about 40 acres. I mean, it just rotted in the field, and I was expecting that to happen with this particular corn, which was the Burley County. And that didn't happen. I'm sorry, it wasn't the Burley County. It was the corn that I planted to suck nutrients out of the corral, which was Shumway's Goliath silo corn. It's an old-time silage corn. Well, this is what it looked like about six weeks later. Most of the shredded stuff, most of the shredded leaves are down low, and it just came on like gangbusters. Look at the dark foliage there. I mean, there's a lot of nitrogen right there, which you can use. You know, you could harvest it for your animals. You can let the animals graze it. You could also just harvest it and throw it on your garden and move that nitrogen around. By July 15th, it was about 12 feet tall, the tallest stalks. It got to about 14 feet tall. Which is not too bad for Kansas. I had it surrounded pretty carefully, pretty well, with stock panels and whatnot to keep the animals from grazing it, and I think that also helped keep it from lodging. That is blowing over in the Kansas wind. That particular corn also produces a dent ear. This one's, you can see it's mildly dented and it's horribly out of focus, but the ears are about 14 to 18 inches long, and 12 to 14 rows on the cob. So there's some grain capacity there, which the sheep also enjoy, but I picked most of the ears to save seed with, and some to grind for chicken feed, and some to eat for ourselves. All right, this particular corn is another one of my hailed out plots from that same hailstorm. This is a Mandan corn that's being, oh no, I'm sorry, this is the Navajo sacred corn that was knocked down by that hailstorm. It came back quite well. These are hills that you're looking at, and you can see that it's tasseling nicely, and you can see silks on the ears. Notice that on a lot of these native corns, the ears are born quite close to the ground, and this, at least in my hands, under my conditions, this corn only grows to about 2 to 2.5 feet tall, maybe 3 feet tall. So it's pretty short. It doesn't stand well either, so it's not something you could, you know, plant in rows and then combine. And that's just another shot of the harvested ears. And again, I've artificially selected, and I do this separately from the corn that I grow for Navajo sacred seed. This one I keep separate because I just want to see how sort of pure I can get the eagle silhouette. I mean, my background is in genetics. I have a PhD in molecular genetics. Oh, dread of dreads, yes. And I have actually transferred genes from one organism to another. Oh no, but I didn't make a living out of it. And So I can't help but do a little bit of genetic hobby fun when I'm growing things like corn. This particular corn is the plant sort of standing back from it. So this is the Navajo sacred at some further point down the road. And you can see I planted some beans in between the hills as well. But this particular corn also is a tillering corn. So if you notice that there are the individual plants, the individual stalks have a number of smaller stalks that kind of grow out of the base. Those are called tillers in grass morphology. Yes, corn is a grass. And a lot of times the tillers produce little tiny ears that we call nubbin ears. And traditionally folks would hand harvest the main ears off the stalks and then turn the hogs in to demolish and eat the stalks plus the glean the grain from the nubbin ears as well. So you can kind of see this is a bushy looking little corn, quite a bit different from the standard field corns that you see. Here's a closer shot where you can see some of the tillering, and you can still see a little bit of hail damage from earlier in the season. All right, this particular corn is a flower corn, a mixed flower corn. I took a variety of different Mandan flower corns and grew them out together to see what kinds of colors I could pull out of it. And you can see that this particular ear was mostly white, a few yellow kernels, but light purple, light blue, a couple of pinks, true pinks, and a couple of true greens. And one of my goals has been to try to grow those out, the greens and the pinks, and see if I can get a relatively pure line of those. It'll be pretty hard on some of those. It might not be possible on some of those because of the genetics involved, but I think I can get pretty close to at least half to a majority of the kernels being those two colors. Anytime you're mixing yellow with blue to make green, you're dealing with something typically called heterozygosity on a couple of different gene locations, and so it's almost impossible in some cases to get pure breeding versions of those, but not impossible. Some more variation in corn that's pretty interesting to me is you can get a number of different sort of shades of red in the stalks. This particular corn here is a really dark purple cultivar that Dave Christensen gave me that is part of an experiment of his to produce a corn that produces, or to breed a corn that produces more anthocyanin, the dark red or the dark purple pigment, antioxidant pigment that you find in things like blueberries, than even the blueberries do themselves. So, and you can see there's a really pretty ribbing and color ribbing on the leaves. Here's the corn that plant produced itself. You can see that it's almost black. This is a flower corn. Most of these selections came from his painted mounted experiments, and then he crossed and recrossed and bred toward more and more and more anthocyanin. And some of these, the actual the little leafy part of the embryo is purplish in color, not so much green. And then what do you do with all that corn that you harvest? Well, you can feed some to your sheep, you can feed some to your... I typically don't because I believe in grass-fed sheep, but I do feed it to my chickens. I used to feed it to my turkeys when I had turkeys and geese and whatnot. And you can also grind it into meal or even really finer flours if you want. You can make hominy with some of it by soaking it in lye water overnight. All kinds of things that you can actually do with this that you can't do with sweet corn. So if you like cornbread or polenta or those kinds of things, I would totally recommend that you grow a small crop of one of these interesting corns that will, you know, please you visually, that will store well through the winter, and that you can create really awesome tasting food with. And I do have to admit that I didn't have a photo of me grinding corn with my grain maker mill. In this particular case, we're grinding spelt berries to make pancakes. And here you have it. This is the final product after you ground the corn into meal. You can make a beautiful skillet cornbread. And in this case, I used Hopi blue corn. Cornmeal from a combination of Hopi blue and Burley County mixed flint. So it's got a flint. Actually, Hopi blue's a flinty flour corn as well. So, and it was utterly delicious.
Well, that's about all I have to say, or that's about all I have time for. I could go on and on and on for years about corn. Here's just one last parting slide for you. This was actually taken of a cluster of ears that I harvested from my own painted mountain patch, and you can see, a whole bunch of different color and texture. Well, not so much texture, but speckling kind of shading variation. One thing that I've always thought is that it would be interesting to develop a color palette of different shades of colors of corn and then serve the upscale decorating market decorators with a natural sort of bouquet of corns that will fit the seasonal decor of a designer home. I have actually been offered numerous times anywhere from $5 to $25 for a particular ear of corn based on its color or its patterns or what have you. So even if you don't want to eat the corn, you know, maybe you've got a really good business model for selling off the decorations. At any rate, thanks a lot for sticking with me. I appreciate it. Thanks for bearing with my tentative technique for speaking into a microphone with no audience. I'll probably get better at this as I go, if I get the chance to do it again. If you have questions, feel free to email me at hwill@motherearthnews.com. If you have any questions about corn or how to grow it or whatnot, I'd be happy to try to help. And and if you do some sort of interesting corn growing experiments yourself, I'd love to hear about them. In the meantime, thanks a lot for listening. Bye.
Well, if you click on the banner over there to the right, that will take you right directly to the Mother Earth News Fair website. I highly recommend going to a fair. They really are just a ton of fun. They're really a great party. I know they're expanding them. I think they're going to have like a dozen or 14 of them around the United States in 2017. So there's going to be one within a drive of where you are, and I promise you it's well worth the trip. It's just the coolest group of people and vendors and workshops and presenters. Really just an amazing good time. I also want to let you know, if you enjoyed this presentation on corn, if you buy the whole summit package, there's a couple of presentations I did when I went down. I went down to spend time with the Tarahumara Indians in the Copper Canyons, and we had two presentations in our last summit on how they prepare corn, that shows you how they do the nixtamalization process, and on how they grow it. So I think you might find that interesting also. Well, definitely click the button on the right and check out the next set of fairs that Mother Earth News is having, and maybe I'll see you at one. This is Marjorie Wildcraft, and you're at the Mother Earth News Online Homesteading Summit.